In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi everybody, welcome to Dan Snow's History Hit. Here's a favourite episode from our archive. Enjoy. Hi everybody, welcome to Dan Snow's History Hit. I've got the very brilliant Eric Thompson on the podcast. He's a former Commodore in the Royal Navy throughout the Cold War. He served on 5 submarines and ended up commanding Britain's main submarine base, Faslane on the Clyde, where Britain's nuclear deterrent is based. He retired in 1998, but his love of submarines has never left him, as you'll hear, because for this podcast, I went round HMS Alliance with him. It was laid down right at the end of the Second World War, completed in 1947. And it served in the Royal Navy right the way through to the 1970s. It's now a museum ship in Gosport, just next to Portsmouth. So I was so honoured that Eric took me around this submarine. He talked to me all about his experience submarines and what submarines got up to in the Cold War. Enjoy. As soon as I arrived in the Royal Navy Submarine Museum in Gosport, just across the water from Portsmouth, we clambered aboard HMS Alliance, and straight away, Eric was in the zone. The tour began.
This is an A-class submarine, and I used to serve in one of these.
Trip down memory lane for you?
Yeah, HMS Anglia. It was 1969-70 when I was one of these, which is a rather long time ago.
And what is an A-class? What does it do?
Well, it's a diesel driven submarine.
Okay.
And this class was built for high-speed transits in the Second World War from Trincomalee across to the Malaya area where the Japanese had taken control. And this submarine is very fast on the surface. It could do about 16 knots. Okay. But in the Cold War, it really wasn't much use because it was very noisy. If they were snorting, running the diesels, they're solidly mounted to the hull.
But the idea was it would sink surface vessels or other submarines or what?
Surface vessels, really. I mean, these Mark 8 torpedoes you would have had are very similar ones.
And these are the tubes, are they?
These are tubes, 21-inch in diameter. One is for keeping beer, the other is for keeping war shots.
There's a beer in there?
Yeah.
Is that something that happened when you were at sea?
Yes, we kept stuff up. One of the tubes, usually. It keeps the beer cool.
Well, I'm glad you're having fun.
And so,
you say Second World War, so this is basically a World War II submarine, is it?
Well, not quite. It's a World War II designed
for
World War II operational requirements, but I think Alliance herself, this one, didn't actually come into life until after the war was finished. The one I was in actually did clock in a couple of months
of
the war. But it's got a lot of modern equipment. I'm not sure. This is emergency breathing system. All these little breathing points are what you'd plug into if you were flooding up or whatever.
The mind boggles. And then you got life jacket here for the case you have
That's for escaping. And you'd need that on the surface once you were up there, because once you've escaped, you haven't any lifeboats. You're just bobbing around. So,
you probably get bored of people saying this, but for those of us who haven't been in submarines, we find it terrifying, the idea of being underwater and emergency breathing and having to escape.
No, I'll tell you, what is terrifying is being in the London Tube in the rush hour and thinking of, the 7-7 bombs going off in the Tube or the King's Cross fire. There's no chance of getting out. In a submarine, you feel you're in control of things. You're surrounded by competent people who know the drills.
Yeah. Makes sense.
What if you're going to suffer from claustrophobia, you wouldn't get beyond the hatch.
Were there any guys my height?
One or two.
I don't know.
I don't know how they slept.
I don't know how they did.
Yes.
What were the suits? So take me. Let's take me through. Now we're allowed to call it a boat, aren't we?
Yes, boats. Right, submarine okay. boats.
Why
yes.
are submarines boats and other vessels are ships?
I think because way back in the early days, they were quite small compared with all okay. the mighty warships across there, and they were very much down market. In the First World War, before the First World War, when submarines came in, they came in 1901 as our first submarine, and it's here, by the way, yeah. in the museum, Holland One. The people involved in submarines were seen as dirty, smelly, piratical, and nothing to do with the real Navy. And in fact, the First Sea Lord at the time described submarines as sort of unfair, underhand, and damned un-English. and said that any submarines who were captured should be hanged as pirates. And that is why we fly the Jolly Roger coming back from war patrols.
Oh, yes.
It's not braggadocio. It's actually, it's two fingers up to Admiral Wilson, it was, yes.
Brilliant. Right, let's keep going. You've got bunks here, torpedoes here. There's not much in the way of sort of separation of space, is there?
No, your men would be sleeping in here. There would be more torpedoes, of course, in... when she was in service.
And is this your personal kit in here, is that?
That, no, I think that's more like to be, probably escape equipment.
Okay.
I'm not sure.
But so certainly bunks suspended on top of gear and...
Yep. God. Yep, and I have slept in a torpedo rack. If you go on board as an extra, as I did when I was a squadron officer, there aren't any bunks for you.
Really? And so you get to know each other pretty well?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Give me the absolute idiot's version. A submarine moves underwater
mm-hmm.
because a bit like a hybrid car today, you charge the battery when you're on the surface and yeah. use the battery when you're underwater. Is that right?
Yes, yes. And in this old-fashioned class of submarines, there's a clutch. So you could, say, in harbour, run the engines and the generators to charge the battery.
Yeah.
When it's seated either propellers, you clutch in. In fact, there's something there.
Engine clutch.
But in these electric boats, which followed, there's no direct drive from the engine to the propellers. The engines just make electricity through a generator, and it's electrical wires which go to a motor which drives the propellers.
Okay.
It's a much quieter
system. So it's a bit like modern electric cars?
Sort of, yes. Now, these are the Conrods here. They're external. Well,
they
move up and down and work the tappets.
So those would, again, if you got your hand trapped in there, that would be...
Yeah, when she's steaming along, these are all going up and down all the time.
Amazing, isn't it?
Really quite noisy.
And do you try, in a submarine, do you try and cruise on the surface where possible?
Diesel boats did, because it's slightly faster. Nucleus wouldn't, no.
So nucleus, because you've got unlimited fuel, you can just cruise along.
Yeah, and also, because the teardrop hull, it's actually pretty dangerous on the surface, if any waves at all, because you're going through the waves. And in fact, in the early days, there's a lookout when Courageous actually went through a large wave off the Hebrides somewhere, and the poor lookout was sucked out, never found. So after that, they had to belt in. But there's no real reason for a nuclear submarine to be on the surface.
And so in the Second World War, or your early service, you only went underwater when you were sort of approaching the enemy.
Yeah, I mean, a boat like this would have crossed the Indian Ocean from Trincomalee and then dive and gone down the Malacca Straits and then look for targets. It's a matter of interest. These are that's the exhaust going overboard.
Okay. When you say dive, I mean, this is so revolutionary. This is as important as human beings going into the air is our ability to fight and operate underwater.
Yeah. Well, I think adding to that, in the Second World War, a submarine like this, it was all periscope sightings for your target. In the Cold War, you're into sonar, and it's listening and sound analysis, very, very high-tech stuff.
And in the Cold War, presumably, unlike your friends in the infantry in Germany who were sitting around, you know, looking at the Soviets through binoculars, you were playing games. I mean, you were coming up against them and testing yourself against the opposition, right?
Well, there were two different kind of branches of the submarine service. One was the strategic nuclear deterrent submarines with the intercontinental ballistic missiles. They simply went out and disappeared. Yeah. Their three main priorities were, one, remain undetected, two, maintain constant communications, and three, be at 15 minutes readiness to fire.
15
minutes. The SSNs, which are what we used to call hunter-killers, their role's entirely different. They go out to find Soviet submarines and ships. And they did surveillance patrolling, so in conjunction with the Americans, were part of the relay. You know, we always had at least one SSN up in the Barents Sea, keeping an eye on what was going on up there. And there's a number of reasons for that. One is you would be wanting to hoover in all the radio signals, radar signals, so that you could record the characteristics of the latest Soviet missile radars or whatever, pick up the communication, see what they're talking about. We'd carry Russian interpreters and also get up close to their ships to get their sound signatures. And with that intelligence, you could feed it out to all the other submarines and indeed anti-submarine aircraft like Nimrods with sonar buoys and frigates. So we all had these encyclopedias of what the electronic and sonar sound signatures are of as many Soviet craft as we could. So that was that one role. The second role was to see if, in our case, the Soviet Norland fleet was looking like it was getting ready to go to sea big time, and if so, why? Was that an indicator of impending war? And the third role would be to try and latch onto one of their missile submarines as it left Murmansk and trail it. And when we've done that, we trail it all the way down to the American coast. So they were quite busy, and that was, you know, the exciting stuff. But, you know, in both cases, we don't talk about... I mean, one of the nation's closest, most closely guarded secrets is where do our missile submarines patrol?
Yeah.
And only three people on board knew where we were. I mean, I was the senior engineer of Revenge, and only once did I know where we were, and that was because we had a particular problem the captain explained to me. But it's normally just the captain, the navigator, and the exo knew where we were. And in the surveillance boats, you know, not everyone knew where they were. They would know they were a sort of sneaky patrol, but they wouldn't, apart from the captain and the people directly involved, they wouldn't know.
So all the crew in here, that, you know, that's the only thing you have for the outside world, depth in feet. You know, you know how far underwater you are, and apart from that, you don't know anything else.
No.
You listen to Dan Snow's History, more coming up.
Hey, I'm Don Wildman, and on American History Hit, my expert guests and I journey across the nation and through the years to uncover the stories that have made the United States. From first flight to first ladies, from stitching the Star-Spangled Banner to striking gold in California, to shooting for the moon with Apollo, we've got you covered. Catch new episodes of American History Hit, a podcast by History Hit, every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermès, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
Now that we're all talking about electric cars, I've got range anxiety. How long would you be able to go in a vessel like this just on batteries?
Well, it depends what you're doing. If you're sitting in the body and doing nothing, probably, I don't know, a day and a half maybe.
Yeah. If you're
going around at a fair speed, then you're using up the battery quickly and you'd have to... probably you'd be wanting to snort every 6 hours.
So you have to get the snorkel up and put the diesels on and charge batteries up.
Yeah.
What depth do you have to be to do that?
50 feet, just a bit less than that, I think.
Okay.
I think from memory, the next class was about 54 feet.
So this, to me, looks pretty old-fashioned. I mean, it's pretty remarkable that you first went to sea in things that were, you know, Second World War, very mechanical, yeah. And then you spent the rest of your career on nuclear-powered
yeah,
submarines.
Yeah, ended up sitting in front of a bank of dials with just a little... Well, in fact, a nuclear reactor almost needs an extra explanation, but the nuclear reactor is so brilliantly well-designed, it's what you called... load following and self-regulating. All we did, if we wanted to go faster, the guy on the throttles, which is just a little tiny lever on a desk, and he just moves it up from stop to full speed. And the steam comes off from the steam generators, which are heated by the reactor, and the reactor then becomes, it's getting cold water returning into it. The cold water is denser, acts as a greater moderator, and increases the nuclear reaction, and it makes more heat. And it just kind of automatically follows. It's quite it's hands off.
Well, that sounds like a miracle to me.
It sort of is, really. Well, now we come into the accommodation space part of the submarine.
This is a galley. So how many people would this be expected to cook for?
I can't remember the exact numbers. I think we had a crew of about 60.
60 people?
And they'd be eating three meals a day and the rest.
Oh,
and the chefs are the most amazing people. They just, I don't know how they do it. It's fantastic.
And is this a...
And this is a bathroom.
60 people. What was the smell like on a submarine after a few weeks at sea?
The predominant smell was diesel. Fumes. Yeah, and these are the heads and bathrooms. Now, you see, the A-boats, some of them anyway, had this little thing to put your feet on because some naval doctor thought it was healthier to have your knees above your bottom when you're sitting
well,
on the
Well, I seat. Have heard that. I've yes. heard that it's better to get your knees up. Now, there was one submarine, a German submarine, that sank with a malfunctioning toilet, wasn't there? So well, there's
Funnily enough, toilets. If you ask me what's the thing that worried one most on, say, a deterrent patrol, it was blockage of your overboard sewage hull valve.
Actually, that's true.
That's not a joke. No. You know, if you've got 150 blokes probably operating the bowels twice a day and if the sewage tank fills up and you can't pump it overboard, you've got problems.
Did you feel when you were in submarines that you were the hunters or were you the prey?
No, we were the hunters.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, British submarines always were.
So surface vessels were scared of you?
No, they wanted to sink us. I mean, during the Second World War, we lost the entire strength of the submarine force during the war, replenishing it throughout, of course, but the strength we had at the beginning was lost. And a lot of our work was done in the Mediterranean, and in fact, although it's not generally appreciated, submarines played a key part in the victory at El Alamein because we were hitting Rommel supply lines from Italy to North Africa. But
I mean, you know, in terms of your ethos, did you, by the time you were serving, how had the technology shifted? Did you feel you had more advantages or did you feel the advantage lay with the surface vessels and the aircraft?
Well, you can be a bit myopic about these things. We always felt we were invulnerable and that they were a target. I mean, we call surface ships targets. That's the terminology. But nuclear submarines, very difficult to deal with them because I mean, they can go as fast and faster than the surface ships. And in bad weather, like, for example, when the task force was going down to the Falklands, terrible sea conditions. Up, you can't go very fast, as you'll be well aware, in high seas, but a submarine can just hammer along at, you know, 30 miles an hour at 400 feet. So it can catch up with surface fleets, it can come up from astern, get
and it's quiet.
And it's quiet, and surface ships, and this is one of the reasons I volunteered for submarines. My father was in the Navy during the war, and he was on convoy, so he was in the anti-submarine game, and I fancied originally being captain of a destroyer. I failed the eye test for being a seaman officer, so I became an engineer. But anyway, out in the Far East, when I was a midshipman in Barossa, an old battle-class destroyer, we used to do anti-submarine exercises against this class of submarine out of Singapore. And we could never find the damn things. You know, they were all, the submarine would fire a green grenade to say, I've just torpedoed you.
Yeah.
And I thought that, well, you know...
I want to be on that team.
We're now in the era of nuclear submarines, and we can't even handle a submarine like this. So I thought the answer is nuclear submarines. And I'd grown up with the idea that U-boats almost starved the country out during the Second World War, and indeed during the First World War. And I thought, well, if this country has got to be an anti-submarine force, the anti-submarine force has got to be submarines. Or is it poacher to catch a gamekeeper to catch a poacher? What is that expression? Poacher turned gamekeeper.
Yeah.
And because of the new nuclear submarines, these massive sonar sets, which they could take deep, you know, so the surface ships are big sonar sets, but they're bouncing around on the surface, and you get thermal layers on the surface because of the sun, that bends sound rays, etc. Submarines duck underneath, you can't hear them. So that's why I volunteer for submarines. And of course, one of the other roles of submarines is to let the heroes from the SBS slip ashore.
So you'd surface, put a canoe on and then they'd...
Different ways of doing it, yes. For this submarine, that's what you did. You surfaced usually at night. Didn't fully surface. You didn't give full buoyancy, and just enough to get the hatch open. Then you get these guys out, and off they go. But with modern submarines, we've got sort of canoe release capsules, you know, sort of steel things, and they just go up into them and then be let out from there, and the submarine wouldn't have to surface.
So this is a Second World War design used during the Cold War. How different would they be today?
Oh, massively different. I mean, almost no comparison, really, apart from the fact that they're steel tubes. I mean, a nuclear submarine, for example, is twice as wide. Well, a sort of early generation Cold War nuclear submarine, twice as wide as this. She'd be carrying 21 torpedoes or more in her fore ends. But the modern submarines are carrying, you know, tube-launched cruise missiles for hitting Afghanistan, as well as torpedoes and indeed things like Sub-Harpoon, which is a torpedo tube-launched anti-ship missile. It's like Exocet, you know. But so they've got a mixed bag of armaments, and then you go to the missile submarines, which the ballistic missile submarines, their targets are 4,000 miles away.
So they're huge.
And they are massive. I mean, a Trident submarine, you probably put two of these inside one.
Wow.
Sounds like they're big enough. Even my gangly frame might fit comfortably into one of those. Don't forget to watch the full-length film of HMS Alliance on History Hit TV. Hope you enjoyed the pod. See you next time.
I feel the hand of history on our shoulders.
All this tradition of ours, our school history, our songs, this part of the history of our country, all were gone.
Thanks, folks. You've made it to the end of another episode. Congratulations. Well done, you. I hope you're not fast asleep. If you did fancy supporting everything we do here at History Hit, we'd love it if you would go and wherever you get these pods, give it a little rating, 5 stars or its equivalent. A review would be great. Thank you very much indeed. That really does make a huge difference. It's one of the funny things the algorithm loves to take into account. So please head over there and do that. It can seem like a small thing, but actually it's kind of a big deal for us. So I really appreciate it. See you next time.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Dan Snow's History Hit. Please follow this show wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps us and you'll be doing us a big favour. Don't forget, you can also listen to all of these podcasts ad-free and watch hundreds of TV documentaries when you subscribe at historyhit.com/subscribe. As a special gift, you can also get your first 3 months for just £1 a month when you use code DANSNOW at checkout.